Okay, yeah, so thank you, Molly, for setting this up. This has been really great so far. Nicholas set a good segue, really, I think, into what I'm going to talk about, which are constraints on adaptation. So predicting how species are going to respond to selective pressures requires understanding the factors that constrain their evolution. However, our understanding of these factors and how they constrain adaptation, particularly in complex organisms, is in its infancy. We have no idea about the relative importance about like how mutation limited this process is, the relative importance of things like pleiotropy and epistasis. It's really quite a black box. And this is, of course, essential to understanding how predictable the adaptive evolutionary paths might be and what factors limit the rate of adaptation in general. Answers to these questions are difficult to address because the evolutionary process has only occurred once for most traits. The exception is when it hasn't. This, of course, shows an example of parallel or convergent evolution, the independent evolution of a similar, exactly the same trait in independent lineages. And given an understanding of the genetic underpinnings of traits like this, this can be a potentially powerful tool to learn about process because you have multiple realizations of the same evolutionary process. And while this is a great example of convergent evolution, it's not a great example at getting at the molecular underpinnings because we have no idea how you make a wing, pretty much. To get around that problem, the example I'm going to talk about today it attempts to get around that problem by looking at insect adaptation to a group of plants in the family Apocynaceae. And this group of plants, in addition to other defenses against herbivory, produce a class of defensive compounds called cardiac glycosides. Cardiac glycosides are potent inhibitors of a single enzyme that's a key enzyme in animals that's involved in everything from neural signal transduction to muscle contraction, osmoregulation. It's also been implicated in roles in neuron development and homeostasis. And the binding site for a toxin on this protein is thought to be no accident. It's thought that we animals produce compounds like this to regulate this protein, the activity of this protein. And in fact, we as a species have been using cardiac glycosides for like hundreds of years to medicinally to treat common conditions like cardiac arrhythmias, congestive heart failure, and a number of other common conditions. And in fact, incidentally, people accidentally poison themselves. I think it's like 1,000 cases a year of people accidentally eating cardiac glycoside-containing plants. So owing to its medical importance, we actually know quite a bit about the molecular determinants of cardiac glycoside sensitivity of sodium potassium ATPase, including the identification of 35 sites that are scattered throughout the protein that have been implicated in insensitivity of the enzyme to cardiac glycosides by site-directed mutagenesis studies. And more recently, there are crystal structures of sodium potassium ATPase bound to representative cardiac glycosides. And here's an example. The cardiac glycoside is in green here, and I've labeled in red these 35 residues implicated in sensitivity. So despite the strategy of this group of plants in deterring herbivores, you actually see that quite a number of insects have no problem consuming these plants, and many go a step further and actually sequester toxins from these plants for use in their own defense. And one example that's known to a lot of people is the example of the monarch butterfly, which is also famous for its warning coloration here advertising its toxicity. But monarchs are in fact just one of a community of species with representatives from 6 insect orders that live on cardiac glycoside containing plants. And it's estimated that worldwide this might involve several hundred species. And so it's the large number of species here all co-evolving under the same selective pressure, and then the detailed information about the determinants of sensitivity that make this a really attractive system for trying to get at the factors that limit the evolution of this trait. And specifically, we're interested in, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Specifically, we're interested in asking which of these sites in the protein are involved in the evolution of cardiac glycoside insensitivity and why those sites and not others. So a few years ago, we started a using a brute force approach based on transcriptome de novo assembly to sequence sodium potassium ATPase in a large number of cardiac glycoside specialist species and non-specialist outgroups, most of which have no genomic resources. And that has allowed us over the years to build up a data set that looks like this, which we've combined with data from others. And this shows representatives from six insect orders, the phylogeny on the left here. Instead of showing all sites in the protein, I've just extracted the 35 sites that have been previously implicated in insensitivity. And in pink are 29 species that are cardiac glycoside adapted species. In white are the non-specialist outgroups. And then so a dot here represents identity with the reference sequence, which is the ancestral form. A letter is a derived amino acid substitution. And the red letters there are substitutions that are known to affect insensitivity. And that, interestingly, that counts for one half of the substitutions we see in the entire data set. And those happen almost exclusively in specialists. But an interesting feature of this data set is the non-random usage of sites. And in particular, two sites in the protein, which flank this first extracellular domain here, account for about one half of the substitutions in the entire data set. The most substituted site in the protein is this glutamine at position 111, which forms a hydrogen bond with the steroid core of the cardiac glycoside. And it has 20 substitutions, 19 of which are observed in parallel. That is, that exact same substitution occurs independently in at least two lineages. The second most substituted site is this asparagine at position 122. It has 9 substitutions, 8 of which are in parallel. And together, those account for about half of the mutations in the entire data set. So why do more than half of the substitutions in this data set occur at just two sites? Well, our working hypothesis is that these substitutions at these two sites are simply less pleiotropic than other possible sites that you could mutate. And evidence for this is that in cases where we've seen duplication of the gene, and we have several instances of this in our data, we in every case we see a minimally modified form, shown in red here, which is differentially expressed in neural tissue, the head or the brain. And then in every species, we also see a highly derived copy here, shown in blue, which has a number of substitutions outside positions 111 and 122. And that's differentially expressed in the gut, where arguably this protein plays a less critical role, but it's also the site where the insect first processes these cardiac glycosides, and it's the site of absorption. And so in summary, at this point, we concluded, after seeing this, that negative pleiotropy is a major factor limiting adaptation in the system. And perhaps more interestingly, it kind of suggested this set of rules for adaptation that you could simply predict how evolution would happen based on the number of gene copies the species had. If you have duplicate copies of the gene, then you'll probably do something like neofunctionalization, like we saw in the previous. However, if you're a naive generalist species, just pick a random one here, like Drosophila melanogaster, and you have one sensitive copy of the gene and you would like to evolve into a specialist that's resistant, the way you would do that is by modifying one or both of these sites, 111 and 122, and you'd do it something like a serial substitution model in this order. And why? Because those two sites are minimally pleiotropic. And so in collaboration with Mike Palladino, we set out to test this prediction by engineering the native copy of sodium potassium ATPase in Drosophila melanogaster to carry these common substitutions that we see in the data set at positions 111 and 122. And so you see that's this first panel here. And then these last three are exploring two more substitutions that are duplication specific, and we actually expect that those two mutations, both individually and together, should probably be more pleiotropic. And so we carried out crosses that would allow us to evaluate the fitness of homozygotes at various life stages. And what we found to our shock was that in every case, every single combination of substitutions we added, the homozygotes were homozygous lethal. Well, so much for minimally pleiotropic. This is not how adaptation happens, how we thought of it. Oh, you just incorporate a beneficial mutation, right? We know these substitutions confer insensitivity, but adaptation will not proceed this way. And so what are we missing? We hypothesized that specialist species might harbor some permissive substitutions that Drosophila melanogaster doesn't have. And if these are common enough in our data set, we might see phylogenetic correlations between substitutions at this unknown site and positions 111 and 122. And so we carried out a phylogenetic analysis using a program called Bayes Traits. And we're looking at all variants in the protein now naive to information about function. And the distribution, so we found a number of sites that were strongly correlated with position 111. The p-value distribution is on top here, and a number of sites that are highly correlated with position 122, shown on the bottom here. And interestingly, 111 and 122 are highly correlated with one another. That's one thing to come out of this. And if you look at the cross-section of these two, that you see three sites that are strongly correlated with both of them. But what really gave us confidence that we were on the right track was this paper, which appeared a few years ago. This group happened to be surveying the same gene, but for a completely different purpose, in Drosophila subobscura, which is a European relative of Drosophila melanogaster. And what they found serendipitously was that some individuals of Drosophila subobscura have the exact same substitutions we're trying to engineer into Drosophila melanogaster. But you, as you can see, that fly looks very much alive. And so we're thinking, well, we wish we could do that. So there are only 19 amino acid substitutions between subobscura and melanogaster, and only one of them correlates with both sites 111 and 122 in this phylogenetic analysis. So we think we've identified a highly correlated site that was previously unknown. And so to test the idea that A119S, which is the substitution subobscura has at that site, is a permissive substitution, we engineered a second series of A119S alone and in combination with some of the common substitutions at positions 111 and 122. And as we'd hoped might be the case, A119S rescues the viability of all of these mutations. And interestingly, it rescues viability of both sites, 111 and 122, and various flavors of substitutions at positions 111. So whatever it's doing to rescue viability seems to be general rather than a specific interaction between amino acid substitutions. To understand more about the mechanistic basis of that fitness interaction between these three sites, we carried out in vitro assays to look at the sensitivity of the enzyme to cardiac glycoside insensitivity by doing these activity inhibition curves. With a curve like this, what you do is with increasing concentrations of the inhibitor, in this case, the cardiac glycosides, you can just read off the concentration of inhibitor required to reduce activity to 50%, and that's called the IC50. But actually, what we would like to do is do this in heterozygous individuals. And the reason we want to do that is because for the first panel of substitutions we generated, we can't make them homozygous. Those guys are dead. So what would this look like in a heterozygote? In a heterozygote, there would be two of these dissociation constants. One that corresponds to the wild-type form, one that corresponds to the mutant form. So based on the shape of this curve, we can estimate both of those. And we can also estimate this quantity F, which corresponds to the proportion of the activity attributable to the mutant form. And so applying this to our panel of substitutions, first A119S shows this monophasic curve, which is not very much displaced from the wild-type form. That suggests A119 S doesn't do much at all to cardiac glycoside sensitivity. We didn't think it should. But here's a surprise. The single substitution here, N122H, we did think that should have an effect. And in fact, we do see evidence for a biphasic curve. And we estimate that the resistant form is associated with substantial insensitivity to the toxin. However, we also estimate that it only contributes far less than half to the total activity. And so this suggested that N122H does encode an insensitive enzyme, but a dysfunctional one. And so in contrast, when we look at the doubly substituted form, what we see very nicely is that this doubly substituted form results in a resistant form of the enzyme, but importantly, the level of activity is equal to that of the wild type. And in fact, these estimates of F are significantly different from one another. But the rationale for engineering substitution lines into whole living animals was that one could go beyond in vitro assays and evaluate the effects of adaptive amino acid substitutions on higher order fitness-related phenotypes like behavior or environment-dependent viability. And so I mentioned that sodium potassium ATPase is essential for neuron function and has been implicated in neuron development and homeostasis. And in fact, it's known that loss of function mutations of sodium potassium ATPase result in susceptibility to seizures upon stress, a phenotype called Bang sensitivity. And to give you an idea of what that assay looks like, you have loss of function mutation for sodium potassium ATPase on the left here and a control line on the right. You stress them out a bit and you observe outcomes. They look something like this. And then if you look at those flies, this is a close-up of one. It's passed out on its back. It's experiencing seizures and twitches. It's trying to reset its neurons. We measured the amount of time it takes for the fly to go poop and write itself onto. Usually takes a few seconds or so. And so to show you that this assay is working, this graph compares recovery times for our engineered wild-type strain versus the loss of function. That's heterozygous. Note that it's heterozygous. Each dot here represents an individual fly, and the solid circles here and whiskers represent the means and 95% confidence intervals. And this confirms that heterozygosity for loss of function results in longer recovery times than the wild-type. Now we apply this to our mutant series. And so first, the first panel, these are single substitutions at position 111 and 122. And we show that when these were homozygous lethal. When they're heterozygous, they have this obvious neuron function that rivals that of a loss of function mutation, which is interesting. But then what we can do is look at the second panel, include that. The permissive substitution, A119S, actually has no effect on this phenotype. And when you look at the doubly substituted form, you see a pattern that suggests epistasis. And that is A119S rescues this dominant neuron dysfunction of mutations at positions 111. And the same is true for mutations at position 122. And so negative pleiotropy and epistasis are both factors constraining adaptation in the system. We saw that adaptive substitutions that we predicted to be minimally pleiotropic were in fact homozygous lethal. They exhibit reduced enzyme activity and dominant neuron dysfunction. And this we found a permissive substitution that rescues all of those negative pleiotropic effects. So slide out of order there. But just to add a little bit of a wrinkle to this, that with some interesting implications. When we look at individuals so far we've only looked at individuals that were heterozygous for these mutations that we've engineered. When we look at homozygous individuals for the permissive mutation, what we again see is this Bang sensitivity phenotype, or the susceptibility to seizures, that is not apparent in the heterozygote. So This suggested that this mutation, though it's permissive, has this recessive neural dysfunction associated with it. And that's actually true of all of the substitutions we tried on this A119S background. They all show the same pattern. The homozygote has delayed recovery times relative to the heterozygote. And so interestingly, while A119S rescues viability and enzyme function in vitro, we shouldn't be surprised that it's also not a silver bullet, and it itself is associated with negative pleiotropic effects that must be somehow fixed by other substitutions in the background that perhaps we don't know about. But a larger implication is that evolution still probably wouldn't happen by a serial substitution model like this, because the first, at least starting with a candidate species that's going to adapt to milkweed like Drosophila melanogaster, it's going to run into a problem that just trying to make that first substitution is not going to work because of the negative deleterious effects. I'm on time. So that said, a second type of in vivo assay we tried was looking at adult survival upon exposure to cardiac glycosides. So to do this, we took 20 flies. We kept them in vials of media containing known concentrations of cardiac glycosides, and then measured counted survivors after 7 days. So plotted here is the relative risk of death for a given concentration of cardiac glycoside. Here we're picking 5 millimolar wabane. This is clicking in and out. Okay. And this 5 millimolar wabane is sufficient to kill all wild type flies after 7 days. Okay. But you see that here are some of our substitutions lines here. They're homozygous for a mutation at 111 or 122 in the presence of the permissive mutation, and you see that they're doing quite well relative to the wild type. That I guess wasn't a surprise. What was a surprise is that this is also true of just the permissive substitution alone. When you're homozygous for the permissive substitution, you're doing much better on coping with the toxin than the wild type control. And so this in vivo assay is kind of contrary to our expectations based on the in vitro assay, which suggested that this permissive substitution doesn't have a measurable effect. And so what's more actually is that if you're heterozygous for the permissive substitution, or heterozygous for the permissive substitution and any of the other substitutions, you actually have, you're about half of the way there already. So this suggested that this protection against cardiac glycoside exposure is actually partially dominant, which is interesting and has interesting implications for how insensitivity might evolve. So either that permissive substitutions, the benefits that you get in a cardiac glycoside-rich environment outweigh the detrimental effects and you just go ahead and fix it. Or an alternative is that you just find a way to keep it polymorphic like this and then add substitutions and work on it, perhaps either adding a compensatory mutation, or another solution would be to just duplicate the locus. And we see duplications happen recurrently in many species, which would allow you to eventually fix a resistant haplotype. So negative pleiotropy, epistasis, and dominance are all factors we've identified constraining adaptation in this system. I think what this work really shows is that in vivo experiments really reveal critical information about the adaptive constraints operating here. And our study highlights the limitations of in vitro experiments. And so while it's tempting to use an in vitro assay as a proxy for fitness, for example, what's the effect of this mutation on enzyme activity? And then relating that to the ecology, the actual fitness of a mutation is going to be some complicated convolution among different phenotypes, ranging from the effect on enzyme function to tissue function to organism function in its environment. And our study really reveals how looking at things both in vitro and in vivo can reveal new features about adaptive substitutions that were inaccessible by just looking at them in vitro. So with that, this work was spearheaded by two grad students in the lab, Andrew Taverner and Ling Yang, and in collaboration with Mike Palladino and George Petschenka. And thank you.